Hello, I'm Thane Kreiner, Executive Director of Miller Center for Social Entrepreneurship.
And I'm Don Heider, the Executive Director for the Markela Center for Applied Ethics here at Santa Clara University. This is Line of Sight, and we're happy to have with us today Rob Shelton. Rob is a practitioner, coach, speaker, author on breakthrough innovation, entrepreneurial excellence, and scaling to drive growth. Currently, Rob is an executive fellow and the board chair of Scale Out Mentors at the Miller Center for Social Entrepreneurship, where he coaches entrepreneurship to scale. Over the past 35 years, Rob has served as a trusted partner and advisor to founders, CEOs, boards, and senior executives at leading organizations around the world. Rob recently co-authored the brilliant Jerk Conundrum, which I'm sure we're going to talk about today. It's a guide for ethical governing and thriving with visionary maverick leaders, some of whom I'm supposing are brilliant jerks. And Rob's work has been highlighted in Bloomberg Businessweek, The Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Forbes Japan, Financial Times, Strategy Plus Business, CNN Financial News, Fast Company, Bloomberg Radio, and NPR. Rob, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. I'm excited.
Yeah. So, Rob, let's start with what is a brilliant jerk CEO? I mean, you use different kinds of terms, visionary, maverick, leader, but how would you define a brilliant jerk, and how do you know when you've encountered one?
Great question. And there's actually several questions embedded in that.
Of course.
You'll recognize the idea of a dominant visionary. We have them here in the Valley, but they're all around the world. I've encountered them and worked with them in Mexico, London, the Middle East, and in Asia. It's not just peculiar to high-tech startups here. But when we look in our backyard here, we can see examples of various folks who, in their leadership style, have exhibited really remarkable characteristics. Remarkable in the first sense because they're real game changers. These are people that you bet on to be able to change the dynamics of business or social impact areas or things like that. But they often have, or coupled with this, a lot of other characteristics. They're powerful personalities, but they're multivalent. They can shift from one mode to another. They are rule breakers by definition. That's why they're in the positions of power. But sometimes they break a lot of rules, some of which step over an ethical line or one of normal business. And they're often unpredictable and capable of behavior that at one time seems as though it's a standard for good leadership styles, and at other times is really not. We have examples of this. Steve Jobs at times was an excellent leader. He created a $1 trillion enterprise as a result of his leadership, but he was a very difficult man to deal with. And people will tell you that worked for him, he was both brilliant and at times a jerk. We have other examples around. So that's the answer to what they look like. I want to emphasize, we have them because we favor game-changing leadership. And these are special folks that contribute to that, make it happen. But they are a mixture of various behaviors that make them a challenge.
So one question that emerges for me right away, and there's a lot of ethical questions I'm sure Don will want to delve into, is it necessary to be a brilliant jerk to be a game changer? Is that a subset of the game changers, or is it the other way around, that there's a bunch of brilliant jerks and some of them are game changers? How do those Venn diagrams work?
It is not necessary to be a brilliant jerk to be that kind of leader. I want to emphasize that. There are many examples. And as soon as I name someone, well, someone will find out someplace where they did something wrong. But it is not necessary.
Things that are wrong.
Exactly. It is not necessary at all. But the problem is that when you have one of these game changers, these mavericks in a place of position of power, you don't know what they're going to do. And that's the conundrum ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to have jerky behavior to be a great leader and to be a game changer. But if you were an investor If you were an employee or a potential employee, if you're the public watching this, how do you know what you've got? The benign, wonderful leader that is exemplary in all regards, or in fact, someone who could lead the company to ruin, cause them to implode. We have several examples of that. Ken Lay was one years ago at Enron. Elizabeth Holmes is challenged in that regard. I mean, that company just imploded because of the missteps that were made.
Theranos, you're talking about.
Theranos is the company. I figured everyone knew Elizabeth Holmes, so I was shortcutting. But yes, that's it. So, but you also have people that have been leaders that don't ever cross that line. But if you're a board member, if you're an investor, if you're an employee, how do you know which one you have? And that's why we wrote the book.
Right.
That's the conundrum.
Right. And so one of the things you emphasize a lot in the book, which we see is really important for traditional, I'll call them Silicon Valley kinds of corporations and startups, but also for the social enterprises we work with at Miller Center, is good governance. And some might argue that the problem, and you talk about this quite a bit in the Brilliant Jerk Conundrum, is what are the practices of good governance that can help keep them in the lane, so to speak, of game changing without being destructive. Can you talk a little bit more about what that looks like and what the responsibilities of the board are in that sense? Because some of the criticisms I've heard about Theranos, having come from the life sciences field, is there was a board that really didn't know anything about the work that was being done at Theranos. And so they weren't asking the right questions to find out whether the science was real or not.
I want to come back to Theranos in particular. It's a good example, but there are many. I just like that one because it's relevant now and it's on everyone's mind. But governance should be an advantage as opposed to a set of handcuffs. When we talk to a lot of board members that are and have been active with these kinds of dominant visionaries, and some of them, frankly, are challenging in that regard. They tend to go outside. But the major point is that the board provides governance that is both helping to create value, that is helping this brilliant person, because I don't care how brilliant a person may be, they don't have all of the skills necessary, or we've never seen anyone that has absolutely all of the skills necessary to pull everything together. They need assistance. And the years of experience that a board brings are extremely valuable, but they also can keep them in the lane, as you say, so the behaviors don't go out of bounds. The board needs to, one, have the right composition. You pointed that on Theranos. Theranos had a bunch of high-profile folks, Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, it can go down the list, General Mattis, et cetera. But these folks did not have relevant experience in this sector. And when asked about it, one board member, when asked, why didn't you look into whether this technology worked? They said, we never thought about it. Now, that to me is staggering, to be honest with you. Enron had a similar kind of thing. The board was well composed, but never active enough. So composition is extremely important. You need people that understand the business, that bring some value, I mentioned, but also can hold the leader to the right lines, but of behavior. You also need them engaged. And that's the part that often shows up. I don't care how well composed the board is. If they sit back and wait to see what's going to happen, you're looking at a potential train wreck.
Mm-hmm. But isn't that the kind of board that one of these dominant leaders would sort of foster?
Yeah.
In other words, if you've got a board full of very opinionated people, that they're probably never going to pick that dominant person, or they're going to clash heads. Somebody's got to go. Right. And so or that new chair might help recruit new board members who are more in line with their vision.
Yeah. You point out another aspect of the conundrum, which is the dominant visionary is going to want asymmetric power, either by voting shares, dual class shares, or just power over the board.
Which we see with a lot of the structure of some of the big name Silicon Valley unicorns is asymmetric voting.
Asymmetric power is important. And you can do that by just having board members that go along with you.
Right.
That's clearly one of the ways. But the board members we talked to that felt comfortable that they were working well with their dominant visionary or and had a history of doing it, mentioned that there was a dynamic that was instilled where you could have a contrarian point of view presented, where you could have constructive conversation. It wasn't easy because this visionary is incensed about their particular pathway to making things work. But effective challenging did go on. And finding that right balance is key. I see where Ray Dalio recently in his new book has come out has said basically that kind of constructive criticism is essential for getting the most out of individuals, teams, and an idea. So it's not a case of everyone's going to go along with the dominant visionary or they're going to hate him. The middle ground is the one that creates the best environment for success.
Because of how fast an idea has to get to market, because of how quickly the investment comes along.
And the size of it.
And because they're, by their definition, they're often setting rules. Do we have a different set of criteria here because of speed to market that seems to foster more bad behavior than a traditional Fortune 500 company, for instance?
And I would add to that, is it fostering more bad behavior or tolerating more bad behavior?
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I think you've put your finger on a very important point. I agree with what you're saying when you put it in that regard. I think we're worshiping at the altar of hypergrowth these days. And that allows or brings people into a mode where they're willing to allow bad behavior or maybe even encourage it. Kalanick at Uber was, in order to drive things extremely quickly, which was in fact his business model, stepping on toes was considered part of the ethics, but actually drove people to overstep ethical and business boundaries of acceptable behavior. And it was all because growth was most important. That plan required they grow extremely quickly. Now, interestingly, they're retrenching and finding that, in fact, that's having a rebound effect on them. But back then, the drive for this growth, this altar of hypergrowth that people worship, was leading to bad behaviors. And it will continue to do that if people don't bring in the moderating force to say, well, growth isn't everything, or at least growth measured by revenues and profits isn't everything. Growth of stakeholder values, the communities that you're working in, and actually relationships with your whole community are also important, and those need to be balanced into it. And that's part of the ethical consideration that boards need to bring.
Well, I'm just going to say, as somebody who's interested in ethics, it seems to me it's always a balancing act, because what you want to do is you want to encourage innovation. You want to encourage somebody who's willing to be forceful and push the boundaries in some regard. But there have to be some boundaries, because there are certain behaviors that are going to be ultimately detrimental to the CEO themselves and to the company. But how do you strike that balance? I mean, when I've hired in the past, you know, we've all hired people, you're checking them out as carefully as you can. And I think it's always sort of a cost-benefit analysis. Is there brilliance going to be worth their obnoxious behavior, right? And what's that rubric look like?
Well, the board needs to set some boundaries, and the board needs processes. And by the way, I include executives in this as well. I'm focusing on the boards, but that community of executives that work on a nearly daily basis with these leaders also are important at helping set these boundaries. They need to say, well, what's in bounds and what's out of bounds? A rule breaker will be challenging convention. I think that is understood. But there need to be guidelines as to which rules should not be broken, where the acceptable behaviors are. And that means relative to the staff as well as externally, legally, or just in business terms. And the board often has been complacent. There's the engagement I was speaking of. Their lack of engagement on this issue of what's in bounds and what's out of bounds, personally and overall for the culture of the company, is extremely important. And they've sat back. In the book, one of the more telling stories we heard was when a new board member attended their first board meeting and was amazed that the brilliant presentations, PowerPoint, but little or no discussion. And they asked one of the longstanding board members, so really, what's the role of a board member? And the senior member said, applause. Now, that exemplifies the kind of sitting back and waiting to see what happened. You know, applaud the leader and say, good, let's see what you can do with it. But that's not what effective boards should be doing. Theranos, Enron are examples. Kalanick at Uber was another one. And that's what led to one board member saying, well, we shouldn't hire any more brainy jerks. But it's not a question of not hiring them. I think it's a question of the board becoming active enough that they're working in concert.
Yeah.
So
I want to push on that a little bit. But before we get there, we talked earlier about this sort of where these Venn diagrams are. And at least the way I heard your answer is that there's a lot of game changers, and some of them, we don't know what percentage, are brilliant jerks or dominant visionaries, the kinds of terms that you use in the Brilliant Jerk Conundrum book. But it seems to me that the conversation that we're having, there's kind of two levels. One is, and you just said this, there's the impact of a brilliant jerk on the culture and what behaviors are tolerated or tolerable, and what the board's role is in ensuring that, I would say, not only laws, but basic human decency is not violated. And a lot of the examples in the book, one could reasonably argue that human respect was compromised severely.
In some of the case studies.
On the other hand, we're talking about, coming back to Don's comments about, you know, is technology unique because of these demands for hyper growth and the huge amounts of capital that are infused in the unicorn companies with the idea that they need to grow really quickly to become dominant and spread over the world, especially with platform kinds of technologies. And here it seems like there's a systems level challenge that the board has a fiduciary to its shareholders. Business Roundtable is now also saying stakeholders, but legally, is that as robust as the shareholder responsibility to maximize returns and the quarterly earnings reports and this hyper growth where the early investors get their tenfold return, et cetera? And if the board members are thinking my job is to maximize the return to shareholders, are they going to tolerate behaviors that are really not acceptable at both the cultural and the systems level view? And are we talking about a need for a systems level reimagining of the role of corporations?
Yes, with this qualification. I'm all for that. In fact, I wanted to get to this topic a little later on, but you brought it up now. So
couldn't resist.
I could tell. And that's fine, because it's been looming over us.
It connects with our work at Miller Center.
Absolutely.
Right? One of the questions I get asked is, you know, what's different about social enterprises? And I say, well, they're doing good things for the poor and the planet. And people say, well, you know, what makes someone choose that instead of another corporation? And I sort of would like to flip that on its head and say, why would you start a company that's not doing good for the world? What's the social benefit of that? And what's our contract, our systems level contract with corporations and society, that corporations can do things that are not good?
Right. Well, let me go back to something you said at the beginning, or at least touch on it, which is the board should have processes in place. I mean, as well, engagement requires more than just, hey, how are we doing? Although, by the way,
and applause.
And applause. Well, the applause is a bad sign. That's one of the signs you've got a difficult situation. That's what we call blinding dazzle, when they're able to wow the board all of the time and they don't engage. But in order to engage, you know, when we talk to folks that have been in there, they need processes. They also need to close the door. They actually are required by law to close the door, have the CEO out of the room and say, how are we doing? Are we managing this person? Are we getting the results? Are we protecting the value that should be created?
And did you find that boards routinely did that, or that they
some
they were some of them were derelict in their duty to have executive session without the CEO, they
had malicious compliance. They closed the door and they said, "How are we doing? Doing fine," and that was it. So it wasn't an honest, in-depth look.
Authentic.
It was, again, authentic. But we weren't trying to develop statistics or anything. We were interested. You know, the purpose of this book was to crack open the door on this issue and to get some light in so that people would begin to discuss it and talk about what should be done. So first off, boards should have a process. Mm-hmm. And it means gathering data. It means having meetings. Some companies actually have their board members attend senior management events and sessions to get a feel for how things are really working. Not what the CEO tells them, but how is information flowing? Are people being treated with respect? Is the culture the one that the board does feel comfortable with? That kind of engagement is important. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to first put that in perspective. The board has that. Now the larger issue, which is corporations. I feel that my entire professional career, I have been battling a single person, Milton Friedman, who in 1970 wrote an essay that basically made him the high priest of hypergrowth, of uneven value development and retention, and even wildly outlandish executive compensation, all get tied into this idea that the shareholders are the only ones that deserve consideration and value creation in the way mm-hmm. the boards mm-hmm. run. So I believe that we are wrestling with that overall. That is now being addressed. You can see that happening. But we've got, 40 plus years of the damage that's done.
Sure.
And so we have a lot of work to do to redirect those. But the book is not a call for revamping the structure and charter of companies and corporations and enterprises, although it leads naturally to that discussion. We stopped short there. But now you have me on my own area of passion, which is I think that this issue of who should benefit from a company is absolutely at the heart of any discussion you're going to have about ethics in business or any activity having to do where the ecosystems are larger than a small number of people. So it's a large answer to your question, but it's at the heart of what we're dealing with. The book tends to focus on what should the board and the executives be doing with this powerful person who in many ways exemplifies this idea that hypergrowth is the answer and that everyone should give in to that. There's an inherent tension there, and I just wanted to add one other thing. The word concerto was mentioned in the book because there is this inherent tension. You should be, the board should be helping, but also restraining these leaders. Mm-hmm. And I think that this tension between what can be gained and created and what behaviors are necessary for sustained growth and capability across a wide range is key. So it's not just a case of mandating something. It's a case of creating systems, processes, groups of people that are committed to making this happen. It's easier to just say there's only one group that's concerned, shareholders. What we're dealing with is a more complex issue that requires a multifaceted approach. But, you know, boards are inherently composed of people that are supposed to be able to do that. That's why you have boards, is they bring unbelievable talent, experience, and the ability to bring about change that with a brilliant leader can actually set the world afire.
Seems like there's two sometimes contradictory skill sets we expect leaders to have. One is, especially in an innovative company, one is somebody who is an idea person, who can really innovate, who can break rules, who can see beyond normal constraints, and has an incredible creative capacity. Mm-hmm. That's a very different skill set than somebody that can manage human beings mm-hmm. oftentimes. So is there a place, is there a corporate structure where you could have the idea person but not have them be managing the human beings, or the sort of health of the company, and also the health of the community in which the company sits.
Which often is also the global community when you go back to the Milton Friedman comments and not pricing in externalities into the products has led us to this place of catastrophic climate change.
It is possible, and I would say we're still working on how to make that happen. And the way that it showed up was recognizing that some of these brilliant jerks, let me go back to the data that I have and the people that we've talked to in this analysis we've done. Oftentimes, these were very young folks, Elizabeth Holmes and Larry Page and Sergey Brin, you know, they were extremely young.
He just stepped down from
and that's part of the story. And so, but what was interesting was that people realized at the leadership level, at the board, at the investor level, that these folks didn't have all of the experience and capabilities. And so there was a gap and that they needed, this is something a board should be doing, that they needed to bring someone else in. And so in the case of Google with Larry Page and Brin, it was Eric Schmidt. And Facebook has done the same thing. And others have brought in what is sometimes referred to as the adult in the room.
Well, and so a really good case example there, coming back to Steve Jobs, is Mike Markkula, for whom Markkula Center is named, right? Exactly. And his role in the early days of Apple.
And in fact, it was that dynamic that helped Jobs become what he would eventually become. And later, he found someone else to help him along the way on the board. So the board can be very important there. The board members can play this role of ameliorating the bad behavior or being in charge of the parts that the brilliant maverick is not really good at, and therefore smooth out, or they can put someone in place and help the team grow, again, at the executive level. So we're working on it. Now, it doesn't always work to total satisfaction, but the idea that you shouldn't expect this brilliant leader, this maverick, this game changer to have the full skill set or be occupied with literally everything, that people should help them in certain areas, is at the heart of it. I think that the employee treatment side and stakeholders are something we're still working on, but at least in terms of getting a better balance, we have the model, which is the board and the executive should be looking to fill in the places where there's either a gap or the person simply doesn't spend enough time there.
And I'd also contend that too many boards don't have enough grounding in ethics. It would be great if boards went through ethical training, because they're the ones that should be holding the CEO and the organization's feet to the fire. But oftentimes, in our experience, we've found very difficult to get access to the board to give them the training they need, and oftentimes might even want to make better decisions. They're going to help the health of the organization in the long run.
I agree that ethics is certainly one of the most essential components. We added that there were other aspects that need to be in there. And so I don't want to leave them out, but I want to diminish what you just said, because I totally agree. But, you know, this understanding of what these kinds of leaders are, these mavericks are, is at the heart of it. You can't just sit back. Maybe years ago, the board could do that. But if you're going to, you know, these leaders are like an engine, a massive, powerful rocket engine or the like. They need a guidance system. They need an understanding and some help about when to fire all rockets in full thrust and when not to, and how to maintain the well-being of those that are inside this huge thing that's moving faster than anyone else. So the analogy to this idea that more is needed, because of this engine that's extremely powerful, I think fits. Ethics is at the heart of it, understanding this individual and also taking the responsibility, which probably touches directly on the ethical thing you're speaking of. But ethics in business is an emerging area.
It's been emerging for a long time.
Well,
it's like, is a seed going to sprout, and are we going to have ethical businesses? And, you know, we talk about ethical businesses and social enterprises, and I keep coming back to this question of what other kind of business should there be? And so that's why I feel like that, you know, and you talked about this pretty explicitly, Rob, that this book is targeted, it seems, to helping board members understand what their role is in providing those guidance systems and harnessing the ingenuity of people, whether they're brilliant jerks or not. And so it's really kind of a guidebook for the responsibility of board members in a lot of ways, which is interesting. But at the same time, there's this systems level question that the book is on how we operate within an existing system where we're still talking about we need more ethical businesses. And it's like, okay, we were talking about that when I was in business school back in the 90s. Where are they, right? And so what's not working about the system that to enable a change in the way that we perceive the role of corporations in society?
You know, I'm going to...
You can push back.
I don't want to push back. You've raised a good question. I was going to do a quick sidestep on that because I...
Over to social enterprise?
No. I just... You're right, but it's not just a business issue. Let me tell you a story. When we go and talk in speeches or various places around, just board members or any place about the brilliant jerk conundrum and what we are shining a light on here, people will almost immediately go, yeah, but what about politics? What about medicine? What about performing arts?
So I mean, there's brilliant jerks everywhere.
So there are brilliant jerks everywhere. And they show up because oftentimes brilliance and difficult behavior and game-changing mentalities cause a whole set of behaviors that can cross ethical lines. And we have this all of the time in all of these areas. So I just wanted to say that this issue of an ethical core that's supported and grown to the right proportions to where it thrives and it's an important part direction is true across almost all of our activities.
I hear that, but you know the corollary question that emerges for me coming back to these sort of Venn diagrams is, you know, if you can have game-changing leaders in any field, business, arts, politics, who are not brilliant jerks, are we obligated? Do we need to have? Do we have to work with the brilliant jerks, or is there a system where we say, you know what, we're not tolerating jerks?
I think that you should not tolerate jerky behavior, but I think that the conundrum is you don't always know what the person you've hired is going to do. In the beginning, some folks were just wonderful, and then something happened, and their sense of superiority or various aspects of pressures of running the business, maybe growing too fast or the like, pulled them in a new direction. So if the rule was, oh, hold on a second, if the rule was don't ever hire them and exclude them, I think that would be fine. But oftentimes you'll find that you didn't think you had one, and you may. So the question is, how can you keep them properly guided towards value creation and away from value destruction?
And so I completely concur that people's behavior changes under stress. There's lots of science that shows that. And whether the stress is because they're forced by their boards and the shareholder notion to achieve unrealistic growth targets in an unrealistic period of time, or because they're suffering from poverty, stress does have negative impacts on people's cognition and the way that they behave. That's unequivocal. There's great data there, and I'm a very data-driven person. On the other hand, though, I think there's sometimes that's the case that you don't know that people are going to behave as jerks. But it also seems, again, coming back to the systems question, that the way that at least Silicon Valley and these technology-centric investors perceive leadership is that we are selecting for people who are abrasive and confident, and the way that we're defining leaders is in a way that we might be choosing people who have some of these either overt, expressed, or latent characteristics. And so one of the questions is, should we be looking at leadership in a different way too? And is this something that comes back to how investors are choosing who they invest in? And it's like, oh, I want someone who is out there way in front. They got to be aggressive. They've got to know it. They've got to be domineering. All right. Are we positively selecting for negative behavioral traits?
I think without a doubt that's happening. People have opted for the abrasive, aggressive maverick in order to achieve their goal, or they were willing to tolerate them anyway. What we're saying in the book is that, one, you don't always know how people are going to react over time. So there's an unknown aspect. But the other part is that you should hire for the right kind of person or invest in the right kind of person. And if you don't want that kind of behavior, find someone who isn't. And over time, follow the money. If the investments are all going towards people who are not jerks, well, that's a great thing. But if you want to at least leave room for someone who might be flawed or inexperienced, but still have the ability to bring game-changing results. And by the way, this is true in social impact as well.
Sure.
And climate change, because there are some jerks in the area on all kinds of things. People with this superiority that are so adamant about things. And I'm only pointing out that even for the best of interests, you can end up with people that are driven. If you want to leave room for that, then you've got to mobilize and empower a board and executives to take the responsibility. So I don't think it's just a case of selection. I think it's a case of governance and selection together.
Yeah.
And I think there's some models. It'll be interesting to see if they are game-changing models. So, I mean, I'm thinking about, and again, no CEO is perfect, but I'm thinking about the CEO of Microsoft right now and the change that company has gone through, the transformation.
Yeah.
And here's a CEO who is very mindful of who he is, who his employees are, what their core business is, and what their stake is in the world. Or I think of somebody like the CEO of Salesforce. And there's two good examples of people who care more about shareholder value, although in both cases they've been incredibly successful in both areas. Not only improving the company, caring for employees, thinking about their role in the world and the community where they live, but also have made a number of very good business decisions.
I agree. I think those are examples, and there are more. But those are examples of someone who is folks that are achieving great business success without compromising either their shareholders or their stakeholders, and have created a great culture. Yeah. And in the case of Microsoft, there was a change in culture,
a significant change.
In the case of Salesforce, he started on day one with that. And it's been impressive because I've watched that company grow and his approach towards creating a culture take hold and permeate all the way through. So back to Thane's point and building on what you just said, one of the best situations would be for investors to seek out or to select folks that have these capabilities and then provide a board that supports them all of the way. Admittedly, draws the lines, but probably those lines don't need to be worried about a lot. If you create the right environment around the well-selected individuals and help them grow that way, that could be the best of all worlds. I'm just pointing out that people are people, and sometimes you don't know what you're going to get. And some individuals are just inherently cantankerous. I'll be honest with you.
Oh, yeah.
You're laughing knowingly.
We don't experience that.
Never. And I was going to say, you notice I left out academics when I was talking about where there might be brainy jerks.
So I'm curious, in working on this book and coming up with the stories that you chose to tell in the Brilliant Jerk Conundrum, you probably looked at a much broader funnel. So there's kind of two questions. One is, how did you choose which stories to share and the complementarity between them to surface these points about the role of the board in effective governance, especially when dealing with brilliant jerks? And then the other question, which is a little bit more of a loaded one, admittedly, because I kind of like those, as you probably noticed.
I picked up on that.
Is there a difference in distribution of brilliant jerks between the genders? And does this come back to the point about the characteristics of leadership that we're selecting for or not selecting for?
The first question. We had a much broader range. I can't remember, but it was over 50 different enterprises that we looked at, and incidentally, even more than that, little packs of information. But we chose those seven in the book because they exemplify different aspects. You know, the asymmetry of power. The whole thing that we're talking about, calling executive omniscience, where these folks become so empowered and they act in certain ways. One is this asymmetry of power. The other one's cult of personality, and the last one was opaqueness. And you can have all three in some places. Theranos.
No one knows what's going on. You can't share the data. I mean, you actually had the whistleblower here,
yes,
Santa Clara, talking about the issue,
yeah,
and the culture.
And so it all showed up there. The asymmetry of power, Theranos, in terms of control of the voting shares. Cult of personality, to be sure. I don't think I even need to touch on that. The books and the movies pretty much present that case story. And opaqueness. Data was simply not shared, even inside the company. Now, you also had that with Steve Jobs, by the way, and it didn't result in the same set of outcomes. So I just wanted to point out.
But you had a different kind of board structure. I mean, coming back to Mike Markola.
And that was the first.
And he got fired.
Well, I was going to say that was Jobs 1.0. But remember, he became, once they brought in Scully, mm-hmm, and Markola stepped down, the dynamics changed, and that obstreperous behavior became prominent and caused him to be fired. Mm-hmm. He came back,
yes,
new board, pretty much, mm-hmm, and a wizened person with, mm-hmm, with some new experience, but new things happen. So, I mean, it's always important to look at a Steve Jobs, because Jobs 1.0 and Jobs 2.0 were off the same person, but let me tell you, the outcomes were significantly different
versions.
And they're in the board. You can begin to see the effects of the board on it. So it's,
yes,
good to come back to. So we chose those seven because they were good examples. And at one point I was arguing with Mark, we should make it 9 or 11. And he's going, 7's a good number. Let's just go with it. So we did it for simplicity's sake, because the truth is that I would like to have included a larger number. But at that point, it becomes a tome, and it doesn't get across the message we were after, which was important. Now,
second question.
The second question is there. I don't have data to answer your question. I think it's a brilliant question. We should be looking for more data across the range of dominant visionaries. You know, what leads to them? And we've identified a great number of things qualitatively, talking to experts, people have experience. And there's some data to back it up. And we're starting to see more come out of business schools and other places. But on the gender side, there's nothing there. There's just not enough data to pick that up. So I can't answer that question.
It's a good opportunity for research.
It absolutely is. But now let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Why did you ask that question?
Well, because I think it connects back to this notion of leadership qualities primarily being defined in traditionally sort of masculine behavioral terms. And I'm not at all confident that the role of business, the way I see it in society and social enterprises, requires some of those perceived leadership traits. So part of what I'm arguing for on a broader scale is that I think we need to redefine leadership in ways that are more inclusive. And by doing so, we may end up positively selecting more positive traits that women leaders tend to express and to a greater extent. So that's kind of where the question came from.
Got it. And I'm not surprised by that answer. I think I wanted to get that out because that is not only an area for research. It's a very interesting call to action, actually. And so I think that's important.
Sure. And we had a guest on Line of Sight with our first episode, Diana Capp. She wrote a book called, mm-hmm, Girls Who Run the World. And just as it was getting published, then Forbes came out with like the 100 most innovative leaders. And there was only one woman listed, a huge oversight, but great marketing for her book. That,
yeah,
it's like this is imbued in our system are these gender biases.
I agree. The number of biases that we have in our system, gender, this idea that it's only shareholders that matter, what economists call externalities. Basically, I call those things that you can ignore, but probably shouldn't.
Carbon emissions.
Yeah,
so
we have a huge number of biases.
Housing.
Yeah,
housing.
Exactly. But let me interject something. You didn't ask a question, but you mentioned something about innovation.
Yeah.
Along the way. The origin of this book started with our work on innovating innovation. How can you bring about better innovation? Because we need it. There are a lot of things, a lot of problems, a lot of things that are broken that deserve innovation. Now, innovation can go the wrong direction, and not all innovation is not good. Sometimes you see financial innovation, accounting approaches. I'm not talking about things like that, but truthful, problem solving oriented, innovation, we think is entirely important. And 13 years ago, Mark and I and Tony Davila wrote a book called "Making Innovation Work" to make it work better and to bring in some new aspects to it. And that book has done really well. That was the beginning of the conversation that, because while we were doing that and involved with Apple and things occurred, that we looked at Jobs and Steve Jobs, and we said, Jobs 1.0, Jobs 2.0. I mean, how do you explain this? The normal structured approach doesn't work. These individuals can take us new places, but the rules for working with them, for governing them, for them managing themselves are different. And then we started having other examples present themselves, not only here in the Valley, but in our own experience working with executives around the world. And it became clear to us that this issue of the behavior of the dominant visionary, which can be jerky at times, is an important element, and it's sort of a wild card. And wild cards can be good, was our ultimate assessment, but they change the rules of the game and the probabilities of success. So it is all around innovation. I think that these folks are important game changers that we should be thinking about: how to select them, how to govern them, how to grow them, which we haven't talked about, but what kind of culture would create an environment where you would actually grow these kinds of folks inside the companies, as opposed to them suddenly descending and saying, I'll lead this charge. We need all of those things. And so that's where this book hopefully will take us, is into this new realm of innovating the leadership model and governance model that we use.
That's great. And part of my takeaway from that is thinking not just about the board responsibilities, but also the board composition.
Yes.
And how do we bring in people who have different views of what leadership means and different views of what the role of the corporation is beyond maximizing profits for the early investors. That there really is a social obligation. There's a contract with an organization that it should be delivering something, a benefit to the society in which it operates. And having more people on boards who share that vision could start to change the way that we govern. As you said, these innovators, regardless of whether they're jerks or not, we want a lot of brilliant people working on a lot of the big problems that we have in the world. And what we need to do is create structures for them to be successful in getting the innovations to improve the lives of as many people as possible. And it doesn't negate the opportunity for people to make money doing that. Mm-hmm. But we need to preserve the cultures and have standards of behavior within corporations that are respectful of human beings in their full diversity, and as flawed beings that we all have our weaknesses.
There wasn't a question in there, and I fully agree with all of that.
Good. Well, this has been a lot of fun.
I've enjoyed it.
We could talk for hours about this.
We could.
Hopefully we won't bore our listeners too much.
No.
So.
Rob, thank you so much for being with us. The book is The Brilliant Jerk Conundrum. And
Rob Shelton. And
Thriving with and Governing a Dominant Visionary.
Very good. Thanks for being with us on Line of Sight.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.